The Month in Review. This past month, things really started picking up in the Maine State House, with the legislature taking action on and the governor signing several pieces of significant legislation. Among the bills that have become law, narrowing Maine's vaccination exemptions for public school students, banning conversion therapy for sexual orientation, requiring paid leave for employees of larger employers, banning polystyrene containers, and expanding the medical professionals who can provide abortions. More bills have passed either the House or Senate, or both, including one permitting physician-assisted suicide and another banning single-use plastic bags. I'm Jennifer Brooks. We'll discuss these measures, the new UMaine chancellor, and more with two of Maine's top editorial page editors. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The legislative scene in Augusta is turbocharged these days, with bills on several key issues being signed into law before the session wraps up. We have plenty of news to talk about today. Joining me in our Portland studio, Greg Kessich, who is editorial page editor with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. What are you following closely? What questions do you have for our panelists about the news in Maine in the month of May? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back, Greg and Susan. Thank you so much for being here. As I went over everything that's happened in this month of May, it struck me that the pace is really not what we're used to as reporters in Maine covering what's coming out of the legislature. Bills are being passed and are being signed. Mal Leary told me, I was chatting with him this morning, that the governor is signing 10 to 15, sometimes 20 bills a day, and some of them are significant. We're looking at vaccination exemptions. We're looking at paid leave. We're looking about expanding abortion services. Greg, why is all of this happening? And I'm sensing it's more than just Democratic governor, Democratic legislature.
Well, that's certainly a big part of it. I mean, part of it is the personalities involved at the top. Governor LePage was a different type of lawmaker or different type of chief executive than Janet Mills. He wanted to rein in government as sort of a philosophical orientation, and Janet Mills is more of a, she wants to make government work. So, you know, that's, they're going to take a different approach when they see bills. But I think, you know, we have to remember there was sort of two LePage administrations. There was the first 2 years when he had Republican control of the House and Senate, and they passed a lot of bills. And then the next 6 years was some version of split control. You know, either the Democrats had both houses for 2 years and then just the House. So that became a kind of different, you know, that was a dynamic. He was not interested in, you know, finding middle ground and working with the other side. And so a lot of what he did was defensive and keeping bills from passing. You know, vetoing bills that he knew had a majority support, but didn't have enough to be overridden. So I think that, I think that's a big part of it. I think what you're also seeing is a lot of pent up demand from Democrats who couldn't get anything even considered. A lot of, you know, things like workers' comp reform that they couldn't even get much of a hearing on before have a realistic chance of becoming law.
Susan, do you see overall themes in what's being passed and signed into law?
I mean, certainly, as Greg said, the state is moving in a more progressive direction with Democrats controlling the legislature. and the Blaine House, you know, there's a lot of momentum to pass as much as they can as quickly as possible. You know, they'll start campaigning fairly soon for the next legislative session, and they don't know if they're going to keep their majority. So they want to pass as much as possible while they are able to do that. So there's a lot of progressive issues from, you know, renaming Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, to expanding abortion access to lower income Mainers. You know, that's where we're going to see a focus, unlike with the LePage administration. As Greg said, it was about smaller government, which you don't necessarily need to pass legislation to shrink the size of government, shrink government programs. Now we're expanding the reach of government.
One thing that strikes me is that some of these bills, Maine is first or second in the nation, polystyrene, and then expanding nurse practitioners, physician assistants to be able to provide abortion services, second state after California. So in some of these vaccine exemptions, one of a very small handful, in some of these bills were sort of Maine is part of a larger group of states, for example, banning conversion therapy, but in some really out ahead.
Yeah, and the thing I would add to that list is the paid time off. Other states have earned sick time laws, but this is the first time I think a state has passed a requirement that people can earn time off for either being sick or for other reasons.
I just point out a lot of these issues have been talked about for a long time, but you know, folks weren't in the position to make progress or to get these things passed. And again, with complete Democratic control, they can move forward on the civil rights, environmental, equity types of legislation that we're seeing being moved forward and passed and signed by the governor.
But, you know, I think the thing that we need to remember before we kind of assess what's happened is that the budget is still out there, and that requires two-thirds support. And there are, you know, some signs that there are Republican legislators who feel like they've been run over on a lot of these, high-profile issues who may dig their heels
in. And we think of... We think of the budget as being about numbers and spending, but it's certainly a policy document as well. And it's, you know, where the governor and lawmakers set out what their priorities are by what they decide to fund and what they don't. And certainly Republicans have a very different view on what some of the priorities should be. So, you know, with the timing, of course, it needs to be two-thirds budget. So they're going to have to get some Republicans to go along. So it'll be very interesting to see what the deal making looks like to bring them on board.
It's interesting you all both bring that up because I was speaking, as I said, with our State House reporter Mal Leary this morning, said the same thing, that sort of the underlying, what's percolating up there is the budget. The Republicans believe the budget is too big, there's too much growth, but they agree with Democrats that there needs to be property tax relief. And that's a really sort of that's difficult math.
Right.
Well, let's talk about some of the bills that have not been signed into law but appear to pass, be passing both houses of the legislature. And this, why don't we talk about death with dignity? You know, this is something that's come up before. Statewide referendum has not passed, but now has passed both houses, the Senate narrowly. Do we know, Susan, if Governor Mills supports this legislation?
I actually don't know, but it's interesting you bring up referendum. I mean, this is an issue where you kind of have the threat if the legislature doesn't pass it, the groups that are supportive will go out to referendum to get it passed through that means. So it's a mechanism that we're seeing used more and more often by groups more on the left than on the right to pass legislation that they want to get passed using the possibility of taking something out to a citizen initiative if the legislature acts on it. But I have to admit, I don't know what Janet Mills' stance on this particular legislation is.
I mean, I think the sick time was another bill like that where the parties were motivated to come up with a compromise because there was a possible referendum looming. And because some of the progressive groups have had success with referenda last few years, there is a very realistic threat that maybe we better take the best deal that we can get now or risk losing the whole thing next November.
And one of the things interesting, you're talking about compromise, and this is coming up, the paid leave bill supported by the Maine Chamber of Commerce and the plastic bag ban that's moving through the legislature now, supported by Maine's Retail Association. So in both cases, organizations that one might not expect would be supporting this legislation.
And it's not because they've been won over to the wisdom of these ideas. They're afraid of the alternative, that, you know, they're afraid the other outcome would be worse. So, you know, they're like, okay, let's have one plastic bag rule for the whole state rather than do it at a town by town basis. Or, you know, let's have, this kind of limited sick time accrual rather than risk, you know, having a referendum and cities passing more stringent ones.
Let's talk about the other big news of this week, which is that the University of Maine system has a new chancellor. Susan Young, what do we know about him?
I mean, he's a very surprising pick for a system that, you know, has long been headed by academics, with a slight exception with the current chancellor, Jim Page. I mean, he taught briefly, but he is better known as a business person. I think folks are kind of shocked to get someone of the stature of former Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. I mean, of course, he's very controversial. At some points, he had a lower popularity rating than Governor LePage. But if you look at his resume, he pushed through change on a wide variety of fronts in Connecticut, from eliminating the death penalty to expanding public transportation, got concessions from public unions on pensions and pay to help balance the state budget. So, you know, he angered groups on both sides of the political aisle. And talking to a reporter in Connecticut yesterday, he said, you know, I asked about the low approval rating, and his take was that, you know, the public just didn't understand everything that he was doing and why it was necessary. And so with so much change, a lot of people were dissatisfied. But that's something the University of Maine System Board of Trustees obviously needs to keep a close eye on. You know, if he's creating discontent more than moving the system in the direction that it needs to, you know, it's gotten much more efficient, but we still have students report problems transferring credits between campuses, which, you know, 40 years after the system was created is kind of ridiculous to continue to hear those kinds of problems. So they've got a lot of work to do, and they just need to make sure that his personality and reputation doesn't get in the way of moving forward more quickly on a lot of the things that need to be changed.
Yeah. You know, it is a political job and it is a communications job. You really have to be able to speak to a number of different audiences. The trustees, you have to be able to communicate with students. You have to talk to the state generally to get buy-in for like a very important state agency that requires a lot of public investment. So if he comes up with a situation where, you know, people don't understand what he's doing, that's not going to be successful. But, you know, he is a politician and he understands about, messaging. So the challenges are really about sort of the demographics of the state, our average age, and the size of the population, and the way we're spread out, and how place bound people are. How do you get the university gives us something, two things that we really need. It attracts young people from away to come live here, and it helps people who are already here, increase their skill level and get better jobs. And so we need that institution to function effectively. But it's the challenges are immense because people are spread all over the place. We have a average age in the 40s or a median age in the 40s. And we have a lot of people with like a lot of college credits who don't have the ability to, you know, pull up stakes and finish off. So.
A huge issue. I know, Susan Young, you really wanted to talk about a column that Greg wrote a couple weeks ago. And Greg, why don't we start by having you tell us about it? How did this column come to be?
Well, I think actually I was listening to Maine Calling. That's where I forgot my original idea. But no, the discussion was around the red flag bill, which is a restraining order that a judge could put on somebody who is perceived to be a danger to themselves or others, and the judge could take away that person's guns. And it's in a process that could be initiated by a family member or a or a police officer or some other folks. And it's, you know, something that we've backed in the past, not because we think it's like, you know, a great savior, but if there's somebody who's really troubled, maybe people close to them could, you know, intervene and help get their, put them in a safer place. And while I was, you know, thinking about this, I heard somebody on your show and I called her up, Jenna Mennert from National NAMI
Maine. National Association for the Mentally Ill, I believe. Yeah.
In Maine. And you know, she was suggesting that it's really, if you're looking, you know, you're talking about a population, the people who are really at risk here, and I guess I should back up a little bit. I've been aware for a while that the suicide rate is exploding, and especially among men, working age men, are by far the most represented demographic group, and they commit suicide or they kill themselves about 3/4 of successful suicide. I know I'm not supposed to say successful suicides.
Completed.
Very hard. Completed.
Yeah, the language is changing very quickly.
And
yeah.
For good
yeah.
reasons, you know. Yeah. And but anyway, so it's a real common problem. It seems like it's a problem designed to tear into Maine's demographic when you think about who lives here. And her suggestion was these are people who have a hard time asking for help, and if you add into the mix that if they ask for help, you might come to their house and confiscate their guns, you're going to estrange them even more. So I started thinking about that, and I found out this there's a website called what's it called, Man Therapy. And it's sort of a funny comic thing. A guy was sort of stereotypical, very manly psychiatrist who has an online screening test where you can go through and it looks out for different red flags of mental disorders or depression, anxiety, and. It just spoke to me as a thing that we need to talk about more. That men are kind of socialized not to ask for help, there's
socialized to be rugged individualists,
yeah,
and
solve their own problems, and they're very critical of other people who get help. You know, we're taught to be that way, and so that there's a, you know, a danger that you could. You know, just get deeper and deeper into your head.
And Maine does have a high suicide rate.
Yes, yeah, we do, and it's one of the things I found from that website that I thought was interesting was that men present themselves differently when they're depressed. Mm. That women are more likely to be sort of self-hating and feel like everything is pointless, and a depressed man is more likely to appear, you know, egocentric and blaming everybody else. And so this explained a lot of things I see when I'm driving around. You know,
Susan, and Susan, tell me what struck you in Greg's column.
I mean, it's just such an important issue, as the column points out. You know, men are brought up to be, as you say, rugged individualists. And, you know, there's such a huge toll personally. You know, it's tearing families apart with the high suicide rate, especially for working age men. It's really bad for our economy because so many young men are not participating in the economy for a variety of reasons. They're more prone to alcohol addiction, to opioid addiction. So it's just something we really, really need to talk about and begin to address. How do we help these men who are struggling but have been taught or believe that they shouldn't ask for help, that they are fine, that they don't really have anything wrong with them? We need them to be able to say, I'm really struggling and I need help here. Things are not okay. I have too much that on my plate and I can't deal with it. We need to find a way to make it easier and acceptable, you know, for everyone, but especially men, to be able to talk about these things when they're struggling and having a really difficult time so that they don't end up addicted or unfortunately dead. You know, this is something that we really need the public's attention, and, you know, hopefully folks in the legislature, the governor, they're all going to read Greg's column, I hope, and take it to heart. We need to come together and we need to do something about it because the consequences are just so damaging to our state and to families and to, you know, the individuals involved.
Well, we will post Greg's column on our webpage and Facebook page. We do need to take a quick break. We're going to get back to talking about the news of the month of May. Your comments and questions when we come back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Diversions, Puzzles, and Games, committed to offering fun, social, and technology-free ways to connect at Hannaford Plaza by Maine Mall and in downtown Portsmouth.
Amy Walter here. Next time on a live special from the Green Space at WNYC, we're tackling the Electoral College. As the movement to ditch it in favor of a national popular vote grows, we look at the pros, the cons, and the consequences for such a move. On The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
The Takeaway is later today at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. If you're a fan of Toby LaBoudelier and Down Memory Lane, you probably know his show airs today, this afternoon, on Maine Public Classical, between 2 and 5, and today is no ordinary day. It was 40 years ago, June 1st of 1979, that Down Memory Lane had its first broadcast on Maine Public Radio, or MPBN as we were back then. We've posted a special short YouTube video of Toby in the studio. You can search YouTube by typing in 40 years of Down Memory Lane. We all congratulate and thank Toby for all his hard work in collecting and sharing so much music from so many years. Here's to another 40.
People only post the best. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the top news stories from the past month. Joining me, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor with the Portland Press Herald. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Bob on Facebook. Please follow up on the fate of LD 640, an independent study of the regional impact on greenhouse gas emissions of the New England Clean Energy Connect, or the CMP Quebec Transmission Line. Also follow up on Seth Berry's bill, LD 1646, a bill to restore local ownership and control of Maine's power delivery systems. Greg, we were talking about this before the program started. There has not been action, as far as we know right now, on Brownie Carson's bill.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's perceived as something that's designed to slow that project down, and it's not being really, it's sort of being evaluated on that level. People who want to slow the project down are for it, and people who don't are not for it. And we know that the governor is for the project. So I don't know that if she's in negotiations with them on some kind of study that she could support, but it's kind of off center stage right now.
Right. Hasn't made the headlines this month. Susan, what about the legislation to take over private utilities? What is misunderstood about it?
I think what's required if that were to happen, first of all, it would be an expenditure of presumably billions of state dollars because the state would have to buy these utilities. So I think that's the very first thing that people don't understand. Maine has a lot of priorities that it can't fund. I'm not sure spending billions of dollars to take over utilities would be at the top of people's priorities. And we understand the frustration, particularly with Central Maine Power, with the ongoing billing issues, people having a sense that the company's not responsive to them, their questions about the reliability of their system after storms and widespread outages, and it takes longer than people expect for them to repair and restore service. And then you've got their transmission line proposal, which, as we know, a lot of people in the state oppose. So there's just a lot of frustration, particularly with Central Maine Power. But I don't think people understand the scope of the legislation. And, Greg mentioned a study on Brownie's bill. If this goes anywhere, maybe there would be a study of what a public takeover would look like.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my understanding of the financing is a little different. It's not tax money they would be spending. It would be they would borrow money, issue bonds and pay them back over time with the amount people pay on their electric bills, which they say would go down because the percentage which a public entity could issue bonds at is smaller than the amount of profit that CMP and Emera successor are allowed to take. Also, they wouldn't pay taxes on any of their infrastructure. So that's also going to, reduce the bottom line. That's like something you could draw up on the back of an envelope. And this you're talking about like hundreds of billions of dollars in long-term investment. It's hard to believe this legislature and we're May 31st. Is going to turn around and vote on a bill that does that before the end of the year. So, last time some of us might remember when deregulated the generating capacity around the year 2000, and that started about 5 years earlier with a study, and then panel of experts, and they took testimony and. And they came up with a plan and brought it to the legislature. And in some ways, that was a simpler process than what they're proposing here. So it wouldn't be. I think you might see a bill to start a process to explore this.
We'll go to Albert, who's calling from Louds Island. Hi, Albert. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great.
Hi. Back to our friends at CMP. This is indirectly related to them. There's a bill to get rid of the gross meter that's been a problem in any solar installer's life. And I thought that it had been passed by both houses and the governor signed it, but then I've never heard any more about it. And also in the same vein, there were a few solar bills that would try and make solar a little more viable in Maine. It had to do with rebate and additional solar, it's called community solar. You could put more people into it, but I haven't heard anything about any of this.
Albert, you make a good point. I haven't heard much either. Susan, Greg, are these in the couple hundred bills that are still yet to be taken up?
Well, I think the gross metering bill was signed with a big fanfare. This is the one where people are going to have to get a second meter. And get charged for electricity they generated themselves on their own solar panels. The other bills, anything that requires money is going to be wrapped up in the budget process.
Susan?
Yeah, I think there is a public hearing soon on the more comprehensive solar bill that Albert referred to earlier. about increasing the number of entities that can participate in community solar. I think raising it from 9 to 200 to make it much more palatable and available option. The bill includes several other changes that will make solar more advantageous. And I believe the bill is sponsored by a Republican lawmaker, so has a fairly good chance of passage in some form. I mean, you know, could get amended, but I don't believe that the committee has voted on it yet.
All right. Well, thank you, Albert, for your phone call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. A few minutes ago, Greg and I, you and I were trying to remember what NAMI, the acronym, stands for exactly. Yeah. We have an email letting us know the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We have two Facebook posts that have to do with the conversion therapy bill. Elaine writes, "I'm absolutely thrilled Maine is leading the way on passing sound progressive legislation like banning conversion therapy. Perhaps we'll lead this country out of the wilderness of ignorance in which it's mired dear ago." And then Jeremy writes, "Anyone who wants to attempt this kind of therapy should be allowed to do so. The government has no business in restricting what consenting adults choose to do." And so a note from our producer reminding us that this is for minors, not for adults. Mm-hmm. Susan?
Yes, that's just what I was going to say. The bill is for people under the age of 18. You asked earlier about broad themes, and you know, through several of these bills, including the ban on conversion therapy, it's heartening to see the state return to rulemaking, lawmaking based on evidence and scientific evidence in particular. You know, there's no research that shows that conversion therapy is effective. In fact, research shows that it's very harmful. I mean, you're essentially telling young people that they're damaged, that there's something wrong with them, and they need to change who they are fundamentally. And that's just not healthy for anyone. Same thing with the vaccine exemption bill, obviously very emotional and controversial. But the scientific evidence shows that you need a very large percentage of the population to be immunized against diseases to make sure that those diseases don't spread. So that reducing, eliminating the number of exemptions in the state is based on scientific rationale. You know, there's proof that that's a good thing to do. So several other issues, you know, on energy and others, it's good to see policy making being based on what the evidence tells us, not based on anecdote.
Maine becomes the 17th state to ban so-called conversion therapy. Now every New England state plus 11 other states in Washington, D.C. We'll go to Robert calling from Freeport. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks a lot. And hi, guests, Greg and Madame from Bangor Daily News. I love your papers. Both of your papers, by the way, are wonderful. Jennifer and guests, this is a bill that hasn't come up yet. It's LD 911, and it's a mandate that for Land for Maine's future public lands that we all own and we acquire together. It's a mandate that's been around for 6 years, and it's just now coming out. It's kind of one of these hidden clauses that when land is acquired for the people of Maine, for the wildlife, you must allow hunting and trapping in any legalized activity surrounding those activities. Now, why is that so? Why should we preserve public lands in you're hiking with your family, and you have to come upon maybe hounders going after coyotes or bears.
Robert, are you saying this is a bill that's before the legislature now?
Yes. LD 911 would mandate that any lands protected under the Land for Maine's Future program must include hunting and trapping.
Sure. And do you know the status of it? Has it been taken up in committee, or do you know the status of the bill?
It's pending for a hearing. It might be held over until the fall. But, you know, most people in Maine don't hunt and certainly don't trap. Why should families be hiking, come upon a trap? abdication of the public trust that you can't go on public lands and have peace and quiet.
Sure, sure. I hear your opposition to this, Robert.
You know, one of the big the coalition behind preserving public land has always had not only the environmental groups, but also the sportsmen's groups. That is kind of that's what's made that such a potent political movement over the last couple of decades. And, I think there's concern sportsmen have of losing access to land that when it goes, when it changes ownership, the most of the Maine forests used to be owned by a handful of people, a handful of companies, and we're very open to letting people hunt and trap and use the land. And as the lots get chopped up and get smaller, there's a feeling people are being squeezed out. So that's my understanding about why there would be this kind of a move. There would be an openness to a bill like this, and I guess we'll see. I don't know. I'm hearing about it for the first time, but I suspect that I wonder if it's going to put a wedge inside that very powerful coalition.
Robert, thanks for your call. Susan, go ahead.
The bill is actually a bond issue to fund the Land for Maine's future, and it does include language about allowing hunting and fishing, which I believe is already in the language surrounding the Land for Maine's future program. It exempts places where hunting is already prohibited. So state parks, federal lands, places where folks are not allowed to be hunted, to hunt now, if those are expanded, those prohibitions would continue. So I'm very doubtful that it means that every parcel that is purchased by LMF or through LMF funding in the future would be required to allow hunting on every single square inch of it.
But, Susan, is this language of a bond? Is this language of a bond that's in place or one that is proposed that we'll be voting on?
Proposed.
Okay.
I mean, the legislature, after they do the budget, they will put together a bond package, and we'll see if LMF is part of it. But this is a bill to, I think it's $75 million for LMF, so probably not going to go forward as it is. But that money for LMF could be incorporated into whatever bond package that the legislature puts together at the end of the session.
All right. Well, thank you. And thanks, Robert. We're going to take another quick break. If you'd like to talk about what news in the month of May impacted you, what you care about, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Marvin Design Gallery by Eldridge Lumber. Handcrafted windows and doors designed to enhance the natural beauty of your home. On Marginal Way in Portland. And McVetti's Hearth and Home, offering outdoor patio furniture, grills, and wood swing sets. Showroom in Yarmouth. More at stovesofmaine.com.
Robert Mueller's investigation lasted 674 days. What happens next could rely on just 19 words.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
Also, new abortion laws push Disney to rethink where it does business, and wild weather impacts millions. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
That's tonight at 9 here on Maine Public Radio.
As the month of May ends, so does the life of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, Massachusetts. So what happens to the plant in that nuclear material?
Plymouth, America's hometown, will be a nuclear waste dump.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll look toward the future and take you back through the history of the plant, plus the complicated and misrepresented history of the Mohawk Trail.
What's not accurate is there's just a whole group of people missing from those histories.
Please join us.
And that's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the news that made headlines in May. Our two panelists today are both editorial page editors, Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I love that our listeners are so smart. We have a tweet from Robert. The Comprehensive Solar Bill LD-1711 was voted out of committee 10-2, ought to pass on Wednesday.
All right.
So there we go. Thank you, Robert, for that. He works in the energy field and has been following this carefully. A tweet from the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. We are thrilled about LD-1050, an act to require education about the Holocaust. Very much needed in these times. We'll go to Jay, who's calling from Harpswell. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify a point about Senator Carson's bill, LD-640, about the corridor. It's a misconception on some people's part that this is intended to delay the project, and the way the bill's written, it is not. It was written as an emergency measure, which means it would take place right after passage and would happen before the next permits are due. So though that's been some of the rhetoric about it, that isn't the intent of the bill.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Jay. Let's see. We're going to go to Charlotte in Facebook says, I hope you will talk about the Mills administration plan to increase incarceration in Maine by moving the women from Maine Correctional Center in Windham to Long Creek in South Portland. As the Portland Press Herald editorial says, almost half of the women are incarcerated for drug crimes.
Yes. It's a concern among people who track this stuff. It's that when you create more capacity in jails and prisons, you end up sending more people to them. And the space needs at Windham are not really being driven by higher crime rates. We're not seeing more crime, but we're overcrowding the prison. There are a couple of bills in front of the legislature this year that would reduce the penalties on drug crimes, and we think that's a better way to go at space problems in facilities like a prison than just expanding your ability to store people.
Susan, thoughts?
Yeah, we have the same issue here in Bangor as the Penobscot County Commissioners consider building a new jail. One proposal is to about double the capacity of the existing jail. It's not entirely accurate because the jail's way over capacity and a lot of people are boarded out to other counties. But, a lot of people rightly bring up, as Greg said, the kind of you build it and they will come mentality. If we have a bigger jail, we'll have more people in it. So certainly, very complex issue on criminal justice reform. We need to work on having fewer people incarcerated, especially people incarcerated for, missing a hearing because they didn't know about it or didn't have transportation to get to it or not being able to post a small amount of bail just because they don't have the money, issues that we really need to take a hard look at. At the same time, the folks who are incarcerated have increasingly complex needs. So many of them have mental health needs as well as substance use disorder issues as well. So I think there can be a fairly strong argument made for having bigger spaces to be able to cope with the complex needs of prisoners. And certainly we want people to get treatment, not just to be held in these types of facilities. So I think, we hopefully can move forward on both tracks at the same time, while definitely not losing sight of the need to have fewer people incarcerated and have them in more appropriate settings, whether that's to get substance abuse help or mental health treatment.
We've made it this far without talking about our congressional delegation and everything that's going on in Washington. What a week it's been with Robert Mueller speaking publicly. We do know that Representative Shelley Pingree has come out as being one of those who says she is on the side of proceeding with an impeachment inquiry. Greg, what are your thoughts about the reaction or lack of reaction from our congressional delegation this week?
Well, for one thing, the two senators, King and Collins, are both on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has the last sort of operating investigation into the whole sort of, Russian interference in the election. And it's a bipartisan committee, and it's been pretty they've been sort of, you know, diligently working away, and we've heard very little from them in terms of leaks. So there's, you know, there's that expectation. And also, if there were an impeachment, it would go to the Senate last anyway. Robert Mueller, well, a number of things have put pressure on the House Democrats to do something to appear as if they're responding more aggressively to these allegations. And there was a lot of people took the fact that Mueller was investigating as an excuse not to say anything and say, well, we're just going to wait until we see the results. And obviously it's a huge the results are enormous and enigmatic. There's a lot of argument to be had, and he made clear this week that he's not going to resolve any of those arguments. You know, he's not going to testify and say anything that wasn't in the report. So it comes back to the House members. Jared Golden is our freshman, has been kind of quiet on this. He has really tried to distance himself from this throughout. He was one of the people saying, let's wait and hear what Mueller has to say. And he referred to the, I think it was the Michael Cohen testimony in the House where he made some, you know, really substantial allegations of criminal activity and said, oh, this is just partisan back and forth, and I'm not going to get involved in this. I'm sure he feels that this is not what the people in his district are really digging for. You know, they're not really waiting for a big stop the whole government impeachment fight. You know, they're concerned about health care, et cetera. But at some point, you know, members of the House of both parties have got to take their responsibility seriously and look at these charges and decide whether or not there's a grounds for impeachment. And it's not something the media can do, and it's not something, you know, outsiders can do. And Robert Mueller can't do it. This is it's up to the House of Representatives. And so I imagine he is feeling some pressure and will probably be feeling more.
Susan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a political process, unfortunately. And Nancy Pelosi, before the most recent Mueller comments, made it clear that she didn't have an appetite for impeachment. It sounds very crass to say, you know, there could be good legal grounds, but politically it could be really damaging to Democrats. And so that's going to factor into their decision. As Greg says, if they're seen as just being investigatory and not taking action on health care, climate change, taxes, and instead just, you know, not letting go of what happened in the 2016 election, that's not going to help their chances in 2020. But it's also important to remember that Robert Mueller emphasized a couple times in his brief remarks that, you know, we know that Russia was making moves to interfere in the 2016 election, and nothing has been done about that. You know, what is Congress going to do to make sure that we don't have a repeat in just a few years? Already, I'm sure, Russia and other countries are interfering in our social media through trolls and bots and all different types of things. So, you know, what steps are we going to take to try and minimize that interference with an election that, you know, like it or not, is right around the corner? So that's really important as well.
Yeah. I mean, the political calculation is really interesting because it's based on this idea that a lot of people just don't care. You know, that some people who didn't like Trump anyway are very upset and, you know, they don't like him even more. And then the other people who, you know, who like what he does or some things about him are just willing to overlook all this evidence. And Nancy Pelosi has said that if he gets found not guilty in the Senate, if they have a trial in the Senate and Republicans vote to support him, that it will be an exoneration for him. So.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word. Thank you both, as always. Greg Kesich, editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Have a great weekend.